This podcast may include adult themes and strong language. It may not. Let's see what the next half hour holds. Hello, and welcome to Comic Cuts, the panel show. My name's Kev F. Sutherland. You might know me as a writer and artist for Beano, Dandy, Marvel Comics, Oink, Red Dwarf, Doctor Who, the Scottish Falsetto Sock Puppet Theatre, and my graphic novel adaptations of Shakespeare. But you probably don't. My guests today talking comics are Laura Howell and Nigel Octolooney.
Hello.
Comic Cuts. We're looking at a panel, and we comprise a panel. There's a few of us, so the panel sees a panel, then we talk about the comics from the panel we've discussed, and we call it Comic Cuts.
I'm so impressed you do that live, Kev. I would have assumed it would be easier to just record that, but...
There is a recorded vocal version. It's dreadful. I have two guests with me today who've brought with them a panel from a comic, or something close. We're going to see if we can identify it and talk about it. Maybe we and you will learn something about comics we didn't already know, or maybe we'll just show off a bit and have an enjoyable chat. Let us see. Joining me from Birmingham is Laura Howell. Hello, Laura.
Hiya, Kev.
Hello, Laura.
Was I right about Birmingham?
You're absolutely correct, yes.
And what is it you're busying yourself with mostly now? Is it Mini?
My main job at the moment is drawing Mini the Minx for the Beano, which has been happening since 2018, I think. But I've been working for the Beano since about 2007. But this is the first time I've been regularly drawing a character that people have usually heard of.
Well, yes, you started with some slightly more obscure characters in the early days, like...
Yes, I mean, the first thing I worked on for the Beano, in terms of my own strip, was Johnny Bean from Happy Bunny Green, which we like to refer to at the time as Asbo's Come to Trumpton. Because the editor had seen some... samples of comic work that I'd done myself, a little mini comic with different strips in it, and one of them was a kind of sort of like a parody of Strawberry Shortcake with really cute little characters, cute visuals, and a quite nasty little sting in the tail. And he liked the idea of having a strip that looked sweet and adorable, but it was a kind of slightly dark and unpleasant undertone to it. Not too unpleasant, obviously, because it's the Beano, but, you know.
Do you prefer getting to work on the classic characters or to have your own characters in there?
That's a tough one, actually, because obviously with the established characters, there's this enormous legacy that they've got. And you're constantly thinking, I've got to do justice to this because, you know, there's all the famous artists that have drawn them before me. And you know, people have known and loved them for decades, so you've got to not mess it up. But I do definitely like drawing Minnie, but I do have a soft spot for Meebo and Zuki, which was the strip I was drawing about 7 years ago now, which was a cat and a dog basically kind of pounding 7 bells out of each other every week, and because I really love animation, so the opportunity to draw something that basically looked like a Tom and Jerry cartoon, just go absolutely mad with the visuals, that was such a pleasure.
And you've also done a Beano manga. You introduced something under that title.
Yeah, that's right. That was another idea of the editor at the time, Alan Digby, because he'd seen me draw kind of chibi manga style comic strips. I've got a book out that I drew a few years ago called The Bizarre Adventures of Gilbert and Sullivan, which is basically a nonsense story set in Victorian England. And that was drawn in a chibi manga style. So the editor basically said, hey, what about if we try and draw Beano characters in that kind of chibi manga style? Which, in case anybody doesn't know, it's kind of drawing normal characters, but in a kind of short, simplified form. And they tend to have kind of more outrageous adventures than the more standard characters have.
But you as a teenager were drinking in manga already?
Not so much manga when I was a teenager. It was very much sort of traditional DC Thompson and IPC and Fleetway kind of comics when I was under the age of about 10. And then it progressed to Oink, the legend that is Oink. And then I wanted more kind of more of that sort of humour comic. So I read things like, you know, Gas and Brain Damage.
Blimey, I've met somebody who's seen my work.
Representing Tales of Nambi Gate, I still love it. And I didn't really come across manga and anime probably until I was university age, so kind of 18, 19. So all of my early foundations were humour comics and cartoons, basically.
Right. Nigel, what was your early intake of comic material?
Well, my earliest was a thing called Pippin, I think, which was for like preschoolers, like five-year-olds, that kind of thing. You know, the sort of thing you wouldn't be able to read yourself, but your mum and dad would read for you, you know what I mean?
Featuring Pippin and Tog.
Yes, yes, that's it. Yeah, I've got a really old copy I found in a charity shop somewhere.
A lot of younger readers won't remember Pippin and Tog. You'll have to Google them. They were made by Small Films.
TV show, kids animation. And it was the merchandise or whatever, the comic that went with it, yes.
So, Nigel, you started with Pippin. You must have moved on.
Well, I moved on, yes. I suppose it went straight into the Beano. Well, not really the Beano. When I was about 10, which all the kids in the Beano are 10. Dennis and Minnie, they're all 10, aren't they? Something happened 10 years ago, but we don't know what. And every kid in Beano 10 is 10 years old. But when I was 10, that would have been the start of the 80s. But I wasn't reading 80s Beano then. I was reading 70s and 60s Beano, especially Dennis, because I was reading the collected issues, the annuals, that were all at my grandmother's house. Even though like 80s Beano was on the shelves, I was reading like a decade or two before that, because my grandmother had a collection of these things, you know.
And those, of course, were what I think we'd call golden age. The 1960s Beanos and the 1960s Beano annuals have Dudley D. Watkins, and they have sometimes Ken Reed, and they'll have Davy Law's Dennis the Menace, won't they?
Yes, The Pippin stuff was like hazy, blurry memories from when you were five, you know what I mean? But the proper solid memories of those early collections.
But you then didn't set out to go straight into drawing comics, and especially not for the Beano. You took a quite circuitous route to get there.
Yes, yeah. I always liked comics. I went to art college, and I did, when I first left art college, I did send a strip in. I wrote and drew a Dennis strip and sent it in, which got rejected, but it was a really nice slight rejection letter, you know. So after that, I did a lot of different jobs, a lot of physical manual jobs, sort of skilled labor, I think you would call it, working with circular saws and milling machines and lathes and all that sort of thing, all very non-cartoony stuff. But in the background, as a hobby, I would draw my own comics, you know. And then eventually I landed at a toy company doing the most boring job you can find at a toy company. It wasn't making the toys. It wasn't designing the toys. It was making the rubber molds for the toys so that the rubber molds could be sent out to China so that they could make thousands of copies, you know what I mean?
Are these any toys we might have seen?
Well, the toy that got me initially into DC Thompson, into the Dandy, was a toy called the Bogies. And the Bogies were these green...
Yes.
Green, they were made out of plastic. They weren't made out of snot, but they were supposed to be made out of snot. And the boss of the toy company at the time said, he knew, because he'd see me like scribbling away in my lunch hour, you know, he said, "Oh, you draw comics. Can you draw as an advert for the Bogies as a write it and draw it a full page strip, you know what I mean?" So it didn't look like a traditional advert. He wanted something that looked like a comic strip. So I did. I said, "Yeah, of course. Get paid to draw a comic that would go into the Dandy as an advert." So they were paying for it as to be an advert, you know, in the Dandy. And that's how I accidentally muscled my way into the Dandy.
Fantastic.
Yes. And it was after it was after a few months, you know, got it ran for ages, the comic strip. The comic strip actually lasted longer than the toys. The feedback from Craig, the editor, was always that the writing was better than the artwork, you know, which rang an odd bell for me because I always got like C's, D's and C's in English, you know what I mean? And I got A's in art, but I was getting told that my writing was better than my art.
Right.
But at this point, I didn't realise I was dyslexic. I just thought getting a C in English meant I was no good at writing. You know, so why is this person telling me I'm good at writing?
Right. So you'd actually been done quite a disservice by the educational system then. Dyslexia, meaning that you were dismissed despite what you were writing.
The comic strips were a way of telling a story using less words, you know. So, you know, instead of describing what people were doing and where they were, you know, you could draw all that. And all you had to write was the dialogue.
So this leads to you writing and drawing The Numbskulls, but being the lead writer for the last few years on Dennis the Menace.
Yes, that's right, yes.
You've made some big changes to the universe of Dennis, including the identities of his dad and his granddad.
Yes, and normally such changes will always be like decided, you know, towers, you know, but I had the idea one day. I started writing Dennis just after Dad got a makeover. Gok Wan gave him a makeover and turned him from, if you remember, he was like bald with a pinstripe suit and a mustache.
Yeah.
And then he got a makeover to look a bit like Dennis. He had like similar hair, you know, if starting a bit further back, you know. So I started just after that makeover had happened. So I just threw it into a script once it was. Dad was trying to take pictures of Dennis, and then it referred back to a time when Granddad was taking pictures of Dennis, and so it was just that throwaway thing that the original dad had now become the granddad, you know. And I was expecting like some sort of like, oh wait a minute, Nigel, what's going on here? What are you doing from Beano Towers, you know? But they must have liked it and accepted it straight away, and now it's become law. It's become canon that the Dennis, if you're old like me, the Dennis that you read grew up to be the dad. You know.
My question to you, Nigel, is what's the deal with Nasher? Has he been cloned over the years many times, or is he just immortal?
He's immortal. There was quite a recent 1 or 2 years ago, an annual where Dennis travel back in time, so he met his granddad, and he saw his father as a kid who looked just like him, you know. And there's a little throwaway line, just one little bubble where Nasher thinks, "I hope I don't bump into myself. I don't want to explain how come I haven't aged." And then I've just left it at that. There's no like explanation. At all, you know.
I think we should have a look at the comic panels that we've brought in with us. I would like to begin by having a look at the panel that's been brought by Nigel. I've asked everyone on the panel to bring a panel to the panel. You can see these images on my website at kevfcomicartist.com or on my Twitter, and you should be able to find it on the podcast page, depending where you get your podcasts from. But you don't need to see these images because we are going to be able to describe them. Aren't we, Laura? Laura, have a stab at describing, without necessarily guessing if you already know, what we're looking at.
Right. Well, my immediate reaction looking at this is I'm glad I didn't have to draw this. Nigel, please never put this in a script for me. So it's a very wide panel. I would imagine probably it's full page width in context. It takes place at night. We're out in the open. There's vegetation in the foreground and a single character kind of hiding behind a tree on the right. They're saying, it's a freeway, we're saved. And what they're looking at is a massive kind of clearing, I suppose, filled with spotlights on poles, rows and rows of diggers, cement mixers, various other kind of large construction vehicles like that, kind of going back as far as the eye can see. There's a helicopter making a loud noise going overhead. Would you like me to do the helicopter noise?
Please.
Chunga, 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 chunga.
Beautiful onomatopoeia. Can I just say, for the benefit of the panelologists who are listening, the people who study line and this sort of thing, we're looking at a black and white line drawing, printed black and white. I don't think this was ever intended to appear in colour. Lots of chiaroscuro, an awful lot of hatching and detail, showing the difference between the dark of the bushes that are in the foreground and the light of the spotlit at night vehicles that are on this road. They appear, in fact, to be laying the highway. Now, I have an idea that I actually think I know where this is from. So, Laura, do you want to have first guess?
I'll be honest, it's not something I recognise, but if I had to take a guess, I'd say maybe something from Underground Comics, possibly.
I would say Underground Comics is exactly it, because I think we're looking at the artwork of Gilbert Shelton, and I think it's from the Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers. Nigel, are we right?
Yes, well done, yes.
Tell us more.
Yeah, it's from a comic called Grassroots, and it's where they, the Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers move out of the city, end up moving out of the city into the mountains. To grow weed and what have you, you know, and it being the very Freak Brothers, all their plans fall apart.
Now, a lot of listeners might not have heard of the Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers. They're very much of their time and of quite a short period of time, aren't they? They appear at the end of the 60s and then they stop appearing in the middle of the 70s. Am I right?
Yes. Yeah. There's only 12 comics were made, nearly like one a year or something like that, very sporadically. You could never, back in the 70s or whenever, you couldn't rely on the next one ever coming out, you know.
You were relying on hippies.
Yes, yeah, very much so, yes. But the Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers are just three, they're not related, you know. They're just hippies who get stoned, and it's the adventures that they have and the trouble they get into.
You describe this in a very matter-of-fact way, but really we're talking about characters from over 50 years ago. And are they recognisable archetypes now? They're three stoners.
No, I don't think they are. I don't think you see such people about anymore. They're very much of their time. And when I first found them, I was into comics. I was at art college, and I just found them at the back, found one. I was leafing through it, didn't know what it was, you know, because I'd never seen such a thing before, you know. These were like the 70s underground comics, you know.
Underground was an interesting expression of the time. Basically, the contrast to mainstream, wasn't it? In the case of mainstream comics in America, you'd have had Archie Comics and you'd have had DC Comics, and then you'd have had Marvel Comics. They were on the newsstands, they were available to everybody, but they were targeted almost entirely at 8 to 12-year-old kids. Underground comics were people who appreciated those comics. They were often really big fans of people like Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko, but they wanted to do comics for grown-ups. And so, Fritz the Cat by Robert Crumb would have been a very good early example. And in this country, Oz magazine, which I think reprinted the Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers, it was the Alternative Society's comic strip, wasn't it?
Yeah. I was at art college, so I may have been dabbling tiny bit in such things, you know. But while a lot of student types or whatever, or stoner types might have been reading it because of the marijuana in it, I suppose. I was reading it purely for the comics, purely for the enjoyment of the craft, the writing and the artwork that Gilbert Shelton was doing there. I absolutely loved it. And it shares a lot of DNA, I think, with the Beano, in that the adventures they have often have like very small starts, very small beginnings, you know, very domestic beginnings, and then ramp up and go off on tangents, massive tangents, you know, and that often happened in the Beano as well, you know.
It's hard to think of any other humor comics of the time. I mean, the Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers stories, being a comic length story of 20 or 30 pages, reminded me more than anything of Asterix books. They were the only comparable thing I'd read at the time.
Yes, yeah. Humor in comics seems to be very rare. I'm a big fan of humor and I'm a big fan of comics, you know, but the two things don't seem to want to fit together. I remember getting rejected from Fantagraphics. This is decades ago. I wrote and drew some comics on my own, a character called Pig Boy, Bunny Girl and Pig Boy. And I sent them into Fantagraphics. And I got this is back when rejection letters came through the post on paper, that sort of thing. That's how long ago it was. It was a standard rejection. You know, saying no, thanks, but no, thanks, you know. But at the bottom, handwritten along the bottom, there was a note saying, but we want you to know something along the lines. We want you to know how we passed it around the office and we thought it was very funny. You should write for TV or something. So, yeah, too funny for comics, apparently. Yeah.
Laura, did you ever come across the Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers?
Oh, I'm familiar with them. But, I mean, only fairly recently, in the last kind of decade or two, I suppose. I think it was probably another thing that I encountered when I was at university. But, I mean, obviously, looping back to Underground Comics, I started working on the Beano on a strip with Hunt Emerson, who, you know, is a very well-known figure in British underground comics and also Beano artist. Yes. And I was certainly familiar with his artwork from, again, things like, we're seeing Gas or Brain Damage. So, yeah, I mean, I've read a little bit of Freak Brothers comics, but it was kind of a bit before my time, really, I suppose.
This is the Woodstock generation that the Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers are representing, when America was discovering drugs, discovering alternative society, starting to say out loud, there must be a different way other than the organization of capitalism. And the Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers spend a lot of their time questioning and attacking capitalism. In this particular picture we're looking at, they're laying a road. And I'm imagining this story is about the desecration of the countryside and the invasion of the cities, isn't it?
Naturally, being the Furry Freak Brothers is a long, convoluted story of how they end up in the mountains. They end up in the mountains with a year's worth of cocaine and lots of money as well. And they use it all up in the first week or in the first few days, and then get like trapped in the mountains and lost in the woods and things like that. You know, they're stumbling in the darkness, like close to death, and then they hear this rumble, and here comes a freeway, and the freeway is being built all in a line, and there's like helicopters coming in with the street lamps putting them down and things like that, you know what I mean? And behind all the construction equipment is the traffic. The traffic's coming in behind it, you know what I mean? And it's very much the sort of thing they were against and what have you. You know, they were trying to get away from civilization and the city and all that business, you know. And in the end, it saved them because this freeway came to them, chewing up all the forest, and he's like eating it up, you know.
Laura, shall we have a look at what you've brought? Listener at home, we're looking at the comic strip panels that Laura has brought with us. You'll find these on my website, kevfcomicartist.com. You should find it on the source panel from the episode of the podcast, but you don't need to because we're about to describe it. Aren't we, Nigel? What are we looking at?
Yes, it's a question of three panels. Morning, a girl has woken up and she her face is obscured. We can't see backs to us. And she goes to see her. She bumps into her mother, is it? And her mother's screaming, what are you screaming at? And then the next panel, her mother's on the floor and the girl's screaming. I don't know if she's fainted or just the look of her has killed her or something. I don't know.
We're looking at the final three pictures of a story, and I'm guessing it's a self-contained short story. Antepenultimate picture, girl wakes up. Penultimate picture, girl confronts her mother. We still haven't seen the girl's face. In the final picture, the mother has fainted, lying on the floor, and the girl turns around. Now, the girl's face is supposed, I assume, to be distorted and ugly. To me, it just looks badly drawn. I've done faces that looked as cockeyed as that.
Yes.
Nigel, have you any idea where you think it's from?
I think it's from Mandy. I'm going to say Mandy.
For the benefit of the panelologists listening, the people who study line and composition, that kind of thing, we are looking at a black and white line drawing that was printed in black and white. Quite a lot of hatching in a style used by European artists who worked on British comics in the 70s, 80s and 90s. I think this is from a British comic. I think it's from a British... I would have said IPC Weekly comic, although their voice bubbles are typeset. And the V end flash, the V end caption in the final picture has got a little silhouette of a bat in it. And that suggests to me that it might be from a horror themed comic. Laura, would I be right in guessing this would be from Misty?
Well, yes, you would technically be correct, Kev. It's from Misty issue 37, I believe.
Ooh.
But if you want a twist in the tale,
yeah.
I've never read Misty. I came across this comic in Barbie magazine in 1985. I was 9 years old. And a little Barbie fan. And I thought, oh, Barbie's got a comic. Brilliant. Barbie Adventures. And in case, for some weird reason, you two guys weren't reading Barbie comic in 1985, I should explain that the bulk of the comic was cute little strips about Barbie and her sister Skipper. They go to Disneyland in one story. And they find a lost horse in another, and it's all very wholesome. But to fill the pages, because they clearly didn't have enough budget to have original comics in the whole thing, they padded it out with reprints from Jinty and Misty. So the Jinty story was a kind of typical schoolgirl thing. And then at the end of the comic, there was this kind of horrible... nightmarish story to me as a nine-year-old about a mean girl who's she's teased and bullied by everyone in her school because she's got spots and bad hair and all this business, and she says, "Oh, I wish I was pretty, then everything would be fine." And she's gifted a magic mirror by a mysterious old lady who warns her that it will give her what she wants, but she must never let any harm befall it. But she gets more and more beautiful, which is what she wants, obviously, but she continues kind of being a massive bitch to everyone. So in a classic you have this coming twist, she breaks the mirror when she has an argument with her stepmom, who's in that panel there. And obviously at the end of the story, she's broken the mirror. So her reflection becomes distorted. And so she now has this horrible kind of distorted face that she's got to live with for the rest of her life. This is not suitable material for Barbie fans. But even now, after, 35-odd years, this comic is absolutely seared into my memory. I don't remember anything else about the kind of, cutesy toy tie-in comics I was reading at the time, but I've never forgotten this mirror story. And I think it's one of the things that's kind of laid the foundations of my lifelong love for both horror stories and kind of, literal Black Mirror kind of twist in the tale stories. I was reading a lot of girls' comics, like Bunty, Mandy, Susie, etc. And actually, a lot of those had at least one kind of scary story in each issue. I think people don't give girls' comics enough credit for the the range of material they had in them. I think if you ask most people about them, they'll just say, oh, girls' comics, it's all, you know, boarding schools and looking after horses and things like that. But there were some nasty stories in there and quite bleak ones as well.
A few years ago, The Guardian did some facsimile reproductions of comics. There was Roy of the Rover, there was an old Beano, and amongst them was Bunty and I think June. And the girls' comics were head and shoulders above their contemporaries. Roy of the Rovers was neither well-written nor well-drawn particularly, but the girls' comics were a very high demanding level of storytelling. And of course, the wide-ranging subject matter.
I often think, going back to manga again as well, that the popularity amongst female readers with manga that's been going on for the last, 10 or 20 years in the UK, I think those kind of desires for dramatic, kind of traumatic, those kinds of stories, those needs were being met by the girls' comics before manga made its way to the UK. Because we've got the same sort of thing, serialised stories. Manga is, serialised. You're always looking forward to the next volume. And nearly all the stories in girls' comics were, what's going to happen next week? Will her wicked uncle find the secret letter she's just hidden under the cushion or whatever? And I think it's a shame that girls' comics aren't around anymore, because I often wonder if they could find that level of popularity again now that people have, got this appetite for manga-style serialized storytelling and very broad range of styles and subject matter.
Well, it's very significant that Rebellion Comics, the people who published 2000 AD and, of course, a video games company, they are reprinting many of the IPC and Fleetway comics that they have the rights to. And Misty is one of them, as well as reprinting old stories from Misty, which are available in trade paperback or graphic novel versions. They're also commissioning new stories. They feel, I think, Rebellion, that they have to do it all in colour, which I think makes it a bit too expensive. Manga isn't in colour, so you get a lot of good reading without having to waste a lot of money on it.
Yes, it's like Sonia was saying in the episode previously, manga readers in Asia will expect to consume a lot of pages in each chunk of manga that they read, and it will come out regularly. So, we certainly don't want to get into a situation where British artists have got to, work 24/7 to create the sort of output that manga artists have to produce. But stories like these, if they were brave enough, I feel they could fly in black and white, because you can be so moody with black and white artwork. It doesn't have to feel like you're just skimping on colour to save money. It can definitely be a stylistic choice.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely not think that, because my three new graphic novels are all done in black and white, and that's how I'm able to do 120 page long books and still sell them for £6. Available on Amazon now, reader. And thank you, Laura, for the call back to an earlier episode. Laura was referring to Sonia Long, who appeared alongside Nigel Parkinson, who, of course, draws Nigel Octoloony's Dennis the Menace. And you'll find that wherever you get your podcasts from. Thank you, Laura. Thank you, Nigel. I've had with me Laura Howell and Nigel Octoloony, and we have been looking at The Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers by Gilbert Shelton and Dave Sheridan. And we've been looking at Misty, published by Fleetway and IPC Comics from the 1970s. Writer and artist anonymous, I fear.
Oh, actually, Kev, I did look up who the artist is for this, so I can give you that.
Go for it.
I believe it is someone called this is a Spanish name, as you correctly identify, European artist. So I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly. Isidre Moniz. So there you go.
Fantastic.
I can't tell you the writer, though, I'm afraid. Sorry, Nigel. No disrespect to writers. I just couldn't find it.
You never know. This could have been one of those writers who went on to be a familiar name working for 2000 AD and other Fleetway titles. Maybe somebody out there knows. If you want to get in touch with us and tell us about these things or ask us anything, you'll find us all on the socials. Laura, where will we find you?
I'm on all the socials as at Victorian Clam. But you could go to my website, laurahowell.co.uk, and all the social links are in one convenient place there.
And Nigel, where do we find you?
Pretty much just on Twitter, at Spleenal.
Spleenal.
Yes.
Why Spleenal? Why Victorian clown?
That's a reference to the first ever Gilbert and Sullivan strip I drew, and it's just kind of stuck.
And why Spleenal?
Because I used to be angry, and it was just like venting and shouting, you know. I've mellowed.
Rather disappointingly, I'm on Twitter at KevF Comic Artist, and you can also find me on the website kevfcomicartist.com. Please click subscribe to be sure of hearing every episode when it comes out. Thanks again to Laura Howell and Nigel Ochterlooney, and to you at home for listening. I've been KevF, and this has been Comic Cuts, the panel show.